everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 46 through 49 of Part 3. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series.
Let's jump right into our listener question. Yeah. And this one turned out to be a lot of fun. Potentially dangerous. Okay, we got this email from Kelly asking which characters we're most like and why. So here's what we decided to do. We're each going to say the character that we most relate to or who we think we're most like, but then we're going to pick a couple characters for each other, which is where it could get interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Okay, do you want me to start?
Yeah, yes. Go for it.
This is probably not surprising because I have said it many times before, but sometimes I think that Strike is the male version of me. Not in every way, of course, because I've been married for 10 years now and have two kids, but personality-wise, I think we're very similar. It is never more apparent for me than when other people laugh at him for certain behaviors or complain about certain behaviors, and I'm thinking, why is that funny? Why is that bad? I don't get it. Mm-hmm. I remember when we talked about during the end of Troubled Blood where he can't bring himself to respond to Anna sympathetically and just grunts or something.
Oh, yeah.
What was that? You know that line? That's so relatable to me. I totally understand him. I just relate to his sense of justice, his sense of humor. I relate to his temper and his impatience with certain things.
Yeah.
Another thing I really relate to Strike on is when he expresses his anxiety as anger.
Oh, yeah.
He does that a bit. That's really relatable to me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What about you guys?
Good choice. This is hard for me because part of me is terrified that I'm actually most like the character I hate and that I hate her because I'm like her.
Who do you mean?
I think you know who I mean.
I can't.
You know who I fucking mean, Lindsay.
I can't possibly think of who you mean.
No.
See, this is dangerous now because I'm just thinking of why you think you identify with her.
I don't identify with her. I loathe her. And that's what makes me worried that it's a self-hating thing.
But why?
Like it's shadow work, you know?
Right. But I want to know why. All she's talking about Yasmin
worst
for anyone
insecurities.
Who doesn't know.
Yeah. Maybe I am an actual idiot, you know? Maybe I do have an annoying voice. Maybe people think my hair is stupid and I have weird little cat teeth. You know?
Why do you think her hair is stupid? Oh, her hair.
No, does. Why I think her hair is stupid.
No, I forgot for a second. It really did.
Yeah, you forgot. Anyway, if we're going with who I think I'm like or who I want to be like, I've actually always identified a little with Nina from Silkworm. Just her energy, her love of books and cheesy but authentic old pubs. The way she cheerfully disavows her former excitement about Fancourt in the middle of a dinner party to just go against whatever Marguerite is saying. I love that. I have said the exact phrase, he can't write women about many male authors. I like Nina. I feel like maybe parts of her and I vibe.
Saying the opposite of someone just to say it.
Yeah.
Checks
just,
out.
You know, cheerfully disavowing previous opinions just because, you know, I'm feeling different right now.
My favorite thing.
You hate it?
I hate it.
I also feel like Elsa. I identify with Elsa, maybe because I also have capital O opinions on my friends' love lives.
Good to know.
And I think we kind of have similar senses of humor. I also think I'd have made a good lawyer.
Animal whisperer, lawyer. The list goes
lawyer.
On.
Lion lawyer. I could be a big cat lawyer.
Oh my God.
like Charlie Kelly with
it's getting
law.
Worse.
Lion law. Oh, I would rip Tiger King apart in court. I really would. Kenz, how about you? Who are you?
I went with Pat.
Pat.
Okay.
Pat's fun.
Yeah.
You vape?
More the snap judgments and keeping to them. I'm like super judgmental of people like right off the bat.
Judgy beast.
Uh-oh.
I just don't say anything.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I can be. I can be. But I'm not easily won over by handsome men. That's where she and I differ. You know, it's funny that you were mentioning Nina and Silkworm because my suggestion for you, Pools, was actually going to be Catherine Kent.
Catherine Kent. Oh, my God.
Because she writes and she has a lot of opinions and she likes to share them online, which seems very on brand for you.
Yeah, okay.
My writing is better than Catherine Kent's.
Well, I wasn't saying that your writing was of equivalent quality.
My grammar is okay.
Oh, we need to buy you that mug. What does her mug say, or is it a magnet?
That is a pretty cute mug.
What does it say?
It was keep clam and proofread.
Oh, yeah, that's what there it we was. Go. Yeah.
That actually would be a cute mug. Yeah, okay. I'll take that remark.
I mean, I felt like that was pretty accurate.
Got some stuff to think about. Gonna go do some soul searching.
I mean, I don't feel like I was wrong.
Okay.
No, I see it.
God, okay.
Okay, what do you have for me, Kens?
I hope it's as brutal.
It's hard to pin you down to like just one character because I feel like you're like a mixture of Midge and Strike.
Mm-hmm. Me, I can see the Midge.
You know, like the taking no bullshit and not following rules that you think are stupid.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Strong sense of, you know, justice. It all works.
It works.
Yeah, those are the two that I would associate with you. But the other one that I was going to choose for Pools, you have that on yours as well.
Tempest or what? Coming up now.
God. No. Oh, my
I don't
goodness.
Think Catherine Kent is as bad as Tempest.
No, my she's God. Not as bad as Tempest.
That would have been absolutely brutal.
My writing is much better than Catherine Kent's. I really hope.
It's the fact that she writes.
That she writes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And posts opinions.
Online.
Yeah, I do post opinions online.
Often.
But of a higher quality. Like yeah, I'm a smarter, more talented Catherine Kent, maybe. I don't sleep with married men either, other than my own husband, who is in fact married to me. So
I promise you it is not that deep.
Okay. Thanks, Kens. Then I'll take it. Because yes, yeah. I do write. I do post opinions online and I would absolutely have that mug. Mm-hmm. Kind of want it.
Okay. So for you, Pools, I picked Margot and Dev. Margot's obvious feminist character. I feel like if a Gloria came to you, you'd do the same thing.
I sure would. And I'd poison her abusive boyfriend while I was at it. So maybe there's a bit of Janice in there.
Okay, so maybe I should go with Margot and Janice. You know what?
Only that poisoning people who deserve it, in my opinion.
I think everyone who Janice poisoned, she thinks deserved it. So maybe
yeah,
we're on to something
let's
here.
Let's stick with just Margot. That is a very flattering one. I like that. Thank you.
Okay, and then Dev, my reasoning for this one hopefully is less controversial than Catherine Kent.
I feel like we listened to you have an entire existential crisis about that.
Still having it quietly.
But anyway, it's because of that specific moment with Dev that we discussed last time where he gets really fired up about something justified, but might feel like, where is this coming from? Are you mad at me? What's going on?
Yeah. Oh, just fired up.
Yes, but it can feel
a lot of angry energy just radiating out of me.
Right at you. Right at you.
I get that. I love the Margot. And you know what's funny? I actually picked Dev for you, Lindsay.
Okay.
I was going to say that you are like Dev because, listen, principled, quietly competent, just going around here, being good looking, doing all the work, nailing it, making everyone else look bad a little bit, unafraid to like speak up.
Okay.
If you feel you got to speak up.
I do that.
Anyone else would be like, go fuck, I can't. And you're like, heads up, they in this thing. And you're going to hear it.
I will take that.
Oh, I also thought you were a bit like Miss Jones. Miss Arthur's for Strike.
Yeah. Almost embarrassing yen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with that.
You've got the yen.
I want to fight it a little bit, but I can't.
You can't. You can't. I wanted to fight Catherine Kent, but I can't.
Okay, so for Ken's, I picked Tegan Butcher. Okay, remember from Lethal White? She likes animals. Right. Mm-hmm. Ken's, you have like 12 dogs or something. So I think that's
it. Do you really have 12 dogs, Ken?
I do not have 12 dogs. For the record, I have 4.
Oh, that's a great number of dogs.
But in dog year count something.
Dog numbers?
In dog numbers, that's like 12.
Oh, she has 4 dogs. She might as well have 12.
You just multiply everything by 3. However,
that's how many dogs you have.
That's how it feels to me.
That's advanced dog math.
I never took class for advanced dog math. I'm not sure how you got there.
But I feel like you might be a little shy to meet Strike, but you would 100% find the bravery to ask him for a picture or autograph because you just had to. Mm-hmm. You just had to.
Can't pass up the opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
So I think, yeah, you'd do all that and be thrilled to talk to him.
Oh, yeah.
So Tegan. And then the other one I picked, this is kind of a joke one, but Lauren, Brian Tucker's granddaughter, because, you know, you're the younger one here, teaching me what the internet means.
Beautiful.
You know, not very deep, but I feel like the old lady at the table sometimes. I don't know words for things. And you're like,
I feel,
you know,
that.
How she is rolling her eyes at her grandpa. Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm here for.
We get that.
I think Pools is trying to come up with an equal... insults to Ken's to return the Catherine Kent.
No, it's okay. Actually, I'm getting, Tempest. I mean, am I going to go down after this and reread all the Catherine Kent chapters of Silkworm to remember just, you know, what vibe I'm giving
it's
off?
It's not that bad.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to have like ginger, like red hair and look attractive from far off.
From far off. Pools, who do you think of?
I agree with both of those. Apparently, we both think that Ken's has a very youthful energy.
Oh, great.
I actually picked Flavia for Ken's.
Aw.
She's a sweet, wholesome girl, right? But you know what? She sees more and she knows more than she lets on. And she keeps it all up in here and on mysterious anonymous voice changer calls.
Yep. Oh, like, wait a minute. The voice changer that Flavia uses is like Ken's bear.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Her bear avatar, I should say.
Like, it's all a mask and you're mysterious under there. Also, she wants a puppy.
Again, it's the dogs.
The dogs. I would also choose Marguerite for you.
Oh, damn.
I think you have the same thirst. Yours is like a bit more smoldering and out there, you know, like more intense thirst. The really, like, going to kiss him on the mouth at the end of the dinner party.
Oh my
purple
God.
Dress kind of thirst, yeah.
I was sitting here thinking that I was just at a Miss Jones level, but oh, man.
No. No, I think you're at the Marguerite. You've got the little bit of like dirtiness to your thirst that I feel like fits with the Marguerite energy.
Well, where am I going wrong not to get the Marguerite energy?
Oh,
now I'm offended.
I had to divide just the kidding. Two of them.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a fun exercise.
It is fun. Also, this might be dangerous to ask listeners to do, but who do you think that we're most like?
Please tell us.
Or tell us yours, who you relate to the most.
If anyone says that I'm Yasmin, I swear to God, I will block you. Okay, moving on. That's a fun question. I want more like that. Send us like more ridiculous questions like this. Controversial questions, apparently.
That's not that controversial.
Some of the answers were. I like how we both just see Ken's as a child.
I'm the youth.
She's a baby.
You're the youth. I don't actually see you as a child.
Oh, we both kind of think you're a youth, apparently.
Pools, you said that you would hate Tempest and Yasmin the most. Ken's, who would you hate the most? Who would offend you the most if someone said person?
Oh, dear. Because those are like the two most offensive ones. I feel like I would be the most...
bad.
Insulted by.
They're pretty insulting.
We literally said Janice for you, Pools, but you are more offended by Catherine Kent.
way more offended.
Oh,
like,
man.
At least Janice was successful in her endeavors for the most part.
God.
No one's reading Catherine Kent's shitty novels.
Maybe they are.
I don't think anyone is. That excerpt was real bad. That was real bad.
Who would you be most offended by, Kent's?
Yeah, different picks than mine.
I can't think of any specific people, but anybody who's obnoxious or like mean.
Like a Matthew or a Charlotte?
Oh, yeah. Matthew would be. Ouch.
Yeah.
I think for me, it would be Izzy.
Izzy?
Yeah.
Mm,
I really, really have a difficult time with enablers. And Izzy, her dismissing Raph's behavior and stuff like that, that really bothers me.
Interesting choice. I like that. Okay, we should probably get to the chapters.
I guess, but this was so fun.
This was really fun. Catherine
Kent. Chapter 46.
In chapter 46, Robin begins to struggle with the church's indoctrination. The epigraph for this chapter. An individual finds himself in an evil environment to which he is committed by external ties, but he has an inner relationship with a superior man. And that is from Hexagram 23, Splitting Apart.
Okay. This is going down as my favorite epigraph of the book so far. We'll have to see how it compares to the others as we keep going. But for now, this is in the top spot. Robin has found herself in an evil environment, but she has an inner relationship with the superior man, Strike. And as we all probably know, this is the chapter where Robin first starts pretending to talk to Strike in her head in order to keep herself grounded and focused. And it is the only thing that helps her think straight, pretending to talk to him. It is one of the sweetest things in the book. There's a lot of sweet things in this book. Mm-hmm. But this is just, oh.
This is it. I love that this speaks directly to the strike that's living in Robin's head, keeping her sane. Bravo. The judgment for this one says, the inferior dark forces overcome what is superior and strong, not by direct means, but by undermining it gradually and imperceptibly so that it finally collapses, which I think is a very accurate depiction of the way that the UHC is attacking Robin right now. They are trying to undermine her with all these sneaky tactics, but Strike is the thing that's shoring her up. He is bracing her against the pressure so that she doesn't crumble because he's the superior man.
It's so good. Mm-hmm. This one's so good.
It's so good.
All right. So this chapter opens with Robin's group schedule changing. So instead of endless videos of all the awful things going on in the world, they're now attending lectures about the 9 steps to becoming pure spirit, which is a nice change of pace, I guess.
Yeah, less depressing, but so much stupider. I might choose the doom scrolling rather than have to listen to this.
So we have admission, service, divestment, union, renunciation, acceptance, purification, mortification, and sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And it says that the first 6 can be worked on simultaneously, but the last 3 were shrouded in mystery, and only those who were judged to have successfully mastered the first 6 were deemed worthy to learn how to achieve the last 3.
Hmm.
I can't imagine what nonsense they're being told with all of this stuff.
So much nonsense.
I guess admission is admitting the possibility, right?
Yeah.
First step.
Mm-hmm.
Service is all the work to the farm. Divestment, giving the UHC all their money.
Yep, important step.
Union, my first thought was spirit bonding, but I don't know.
I think that spirit bonding is important enough to their bottom line to be right up here. They want those unions for the baby machine.
Renunciation, turning completely away from the bubble world.
Yes, no more outside for you.
Acceptance, I don't know, accepting the lifestyle.
I think from what we've read, it's accepting rather than understanding the cult doctrine. Because this is the step that Will gets stuck on, right? He wants to understand, which means he's thinking too much. They don't want you thinking. They want you to turn off your brain and fully embrace the cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
They want it just, yes, of course, that these 2-3 conflicting ideas are all totally true at the same time. I don't need to understand that.
I imagine the thing about the final 3 not being explained until you properly achieve the others is just a way to make sure that no one ever does reach the end, really.
Yeah. I have a feeling that few members actually go pure spirit. I mean, we know that Becca has.
But there's a reason.
Yeah. So maybe just the most diehard useful ones and principles and stuff.
Yeah.
You know what? These don't even make a good acronym. Like, what are they? Azdurapms. That's.
Yeah, they should have made it something.
They should have made a better acronym for that. If they want people to remember it, you got to do a better job here. Something catchy.
Cult tips from Pools.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I remember feeling very nervous and upset at this part where it says that Robin's medium-sized tracksuit bottoms were constantly falling down because she'd lost so much weight.
Mm.
I mean, medium, based on everything we know, I think Robin's fairly slim already.
Mm-hmm.
So reading this was very concerning.
If they're given new tracksuits once a week, why can't they just switch her to small ones? Like, I'd be driven nuts when my pants slipping down like that all the time. Give her a different size, for God's sake.
Yeah, I don't know.
Ugh, how annoying.
Of course, the next sentence is even worse when it says, other than the irritation of having to constantly pull them up again, this didn't trouble her nearly as much as the awareness that she was slowly becoming institutionalized. And then, gradually, though, she'd stopped noticing her exhaustion and had adapted to making do with less food. She was alarmed to find the unconscious habit of chanting under her breath becoming more frequent, and she'd even caught herself thinking in the church's language.
Yeah, I think the reason this worried me so much was not because I thought she'd believe, but there is a difference between believing and being institutionalized. It's so hard to see Robin getting used to these kinds of things.
It really is. And it has to be a really disturbing feeling being lucid enough to realize that you're being institutionalized.
I mean, at least she doesn't notice the hunger or exhaustion as much, which maybe makes the minute to minute a bit less miserable.
Yeah.
The chanting and the inner thought changes are the most alarming for me.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so her first strategy at maintaining objectivity is to apply logic and observation. So the first and foremost thing that she notes is a really chilling after effect of all of the brainwashing and abuse. And that is the disproportionate amount of gratitude that recruits at Chapman Farm show for even the smallest acts of kindness.
This was another concerning thing where it says that she too was craving their approval. And I know it's out of self-preservation, but look at where she is at that darkest moment on her last day. This is the most dangerous thing for her because it means more than being used to no food or sleep. It doesn't matter if you believe, you just comply out of fear.
And the seeking approval thing, like if she's going to do the job she's there for and then escape, she cannot want to please the church leaders.
Yeah.
She needs to be able to do things that will bring them down.
Right.
But oh, so here, if anyone's keeping track, we get another reference to Disneyland.
Did I miss it? I'm fired.
Oh boy.
You missed it.
I'm fired.
Wow.
Shame.
Take away my Disney pass.
Shame. Shame. Mm-hmm. It's when Robin notices how excited the children are on the rare occasion that they're allowed to have supervised time in the woods. The creepy murder woods are Disneyland to these children.
Yeah, that's so depressing.
So Robin's strategy of keeping herself intellectually detached from the indoctrination by analyzing everything that's happening would seem to make sense on the surface level, but it doesn't end up working, right? And intellect is wonderful and all, but do you know what's even more powerful than that? Do you know? Say it. Say it. What's love? More powerful?
Love.
Love. We nailed it. Yes. The heart.
But this chapter was a roller coaster of emotion because I went from all this worry and feeling unsettled to having the biggest smile on my face. And I think we just have to read the whole thing.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Kenz, do you want to read it?
Yes. Let's do it. All right. Oh my God. Wow. I love this part so much.
Me too.
Finally, Robin hit upon the trick of imagining herself telling Strike what she was up to. This forced her to discard all church jargon because he wouldn't understand or, more likely, would mock it. The idea of Strike laughing at what she was having to do, though she did him the credit of doubting he'd find revelation amusing, was a better means of keeping a foothold in the reality that lay outside Chapman Farm, and even broke the chanting habit because she trained herself to imagine Strike grinning at her when she found herself doing it. Not once did it occur to Robin that she might have imagined talking to Murphy or any of her female friends rather than Strike. She was desperately looking forward to his next letter, partly because she wanted to hear his opinion on the Polaroid she'd placed in the plastic rock the previous Thursday, but also because the sight of his handwriting proved he was real, not just a useful figment of her imagination.
Oh, he's real, Robin.
He's super real.
And I know I said a couple episodes ago that I wished Robin had thought more about how she was in love with Strike in this book, but J.K. Rowling sure knows how to say it without actually saying the words, doesn't she? Because this is swoontastic, is what this is.
It is. It's so gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's love. This man has been living in her head rent-free for a long time, but now he's earning his keep in there by saving her sanity.
I know we've discussed how Strike likes making Robin laugh before, but I feel like in this book especially, I get the impression that making Strike grin just might be her equivalent.
Aww. It feels like when Robin thinks about this, looking at her grinning, there's something in that about them, the way he's looking at her and grinning. Yes.
Yeah. It's so cute.
Yeah. And the fact that it did not even once occur to this woman to imagine Murphy or anyone else in Strike's place speaks volumes.
Who?
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 Right?
Never heard
Murphy
of him.
Who?
I think it's pretty clear who her main man is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just it like is. She's the most important person in Strike's life. He's the most important person in hers.
Absolutely.
I think this demonstrates that.
You know, I wonder if Strike will ever find out that he was her touchstone and part of what she thought of when she was about to drown.
Oh my God.
It might be wishful thinking, but oh my God, how amazing would that be?
No, someday.
I would literally kill someone to have her tell him this if I had to. I would commit murder. I would. I would pay any amount of money for this to happen. I would do it.
Even if we don't see this, this for sure happens at some point in
it
the future.
It happened in my head. Yes.
Absolutely. So her touchstone. This is one of the most romantic things that happens in this book.
In this series, in my opinion. Yeah.
I agree.
It's up there for the whole series so far.
So far.
We don't even know what's coming up. We don't even know.
I feel like that just gave me secondhand butterflies just thinking about possibilities.
Oh my God.
You know what it just immediately makes me think of when Robin thinks about how Matthew's proposal had been the most perfect proposal in all of matrimony.
Oh.
Okay, Robin.
And we don't know.
Buckle up, girl.
But Joe knows. And she's just keeping it inside her brain.
Another thing I really love about this is how specifically thinking of Strike mocking everything was helpful to her. I like this so much. One, maybe because I relate a little bit, but also because this is, it's true to Strike and his character. Mm-hmm. Some of the funniest bits in Trouble Blood for me are when he's mocking at all the astrology and stuff. It's just so funny. But it's a funny part of his personality that's now become the key to her sanity. And I think it helps her so much because when you're surrounded by all the cult nonsense, you can forget that it's absurd when you're living it every single day. Mm-hmm. She's too far into the fear and the environment, and she needs this specific aspect of Shrike's personality to remind her that it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Which, come to think of it, ridiculous is the right word, isn't it? It's just like the spell ridiculous, because you have to laugh at something to remove the fear.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
You connected the dots.
That's mm-hmm. exactly what's happening with Robin thinking of Shrike mocking the UHC. He's mm-hmm. the skates on the spider legs.
I was going to say, is Wace wearing roller skates now?
Yeah. He's Mrs. Longbottom's hat on Snape, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's not just providing laughs in, you know, in her head, but he's providing the chocolate. This is very Prisoner of Azkaban connected.
Very prisoner. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Robin makes it to the Rock again that night, and Strike has left her his longest note yet. And not one, mm-hmm. but two Cadbury flakes.
I don't really know what those are, but I'm mm-hmm. sure Robin loved it.
And there's two.
They're like milk chocolate that's been like mm-hmm. thinned and then folded over a bunch. So it's like air and,
okay,
you know, it's really crumbly and they don't melt properly. Maybe she really likes these. I don't know.
Okay, well, now I'm obsessed with the idea that Strike is going through his memory and buying her chocolates that he knows she likes.
That would be very cute. Yeah. I would like
also
that
thinking
as well.
Of him going to the shops for these.
Oh,
I gotta go and get my Robin snacks.
Picking out her chocolate for her. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Okay.
Very cute. She also realizes that there isn't a note from Murphy and doesn't seem too upset. But let's be honest, chocolate is greater than notes from Murphy.
Oh, definitely. But most things are better than Murphy, though. A good slice of pizza is better than Murphy.
Oh. A mediocre slice of pizza.
Oh, damn.
People are not going to be happy with us for this.
No, I'm sorry. I actually, you know, I'm still on there. He could be either one.
Yeah.
In theory, in practice, it turns out I like to dunk on Murphy a lot. Sorry.
It's okay. It's just loyalty.
Yeah, it's loyalty. You know. It's like football rivals, you right. know. Yeah, Strike's yeah, yeah. going to be out here insulting the Tottenham Spurs because mm-hmm. that's what you do.
Exactly.
They're your rivals.
It's what you do.
But if you can imagine the disappointment Robin would feel at no note from Strike versus basically the non-reaction to no note from Murphy, it should really be a hint to her, you know? It says that she's too nervous and ravenous to worry about the missing note now, but the fact that she'd be worrying rather than heartbroken, I feel, is a red flag. She isn't really emotionally invested and attached to Murphy's letter. She's not depending on seeing him the way she depends emotionally on seeing Strike. And that should be a big hint.
All I can think of is, this belongs here, you know, what she says at the end.
Oh, yeah. This belongs here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The first paragraph in Strike's letter is all about the Polaroids.
Pools, I was going to ask you about timeline stuff. Strike says the tin comes from 87. Does that fit with Abigail?
Wace and Abigail moved to the farm in 1988 when she was 7. So presuming that the biscuits were still sold in this tin for at least a few years after 87, then I'd say, yeah, it fits.
Okay.
It fits all right.
So then Strike gives her an update on the Franks and the Little John situation, just like he normally does.
I really like when he was telling her that the potential new hire fell through because the person went to work for Patterson instead. And he said, maybe he just thought I was a dick. That made me laugh.
That did make me laugh. They usually interview people together, right? Maybe Robin acts as kind of like a counterbalance to Strike's resting grumpy face. And she draws the new subcontractors in because she's so lovely. Or maybe Strike was extra grumpy in the interview because he misses Robin so much and came off a bit as a dick.
Well, see, this piques my interest, though.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think either of those things.
No.
Strike knows how to do an interview.
Yeah.
So I'm interested because of how much Strike tells her about this. Basically, how much information we, the reader, are getting.
Yes.
Right. A friend of Wardle's told Strike he was going to work for Patterson because the pay is better, but that Dev says that's not true, that Strike and Robin pay better, which is why Strike joked, maybe he just thought I was a dick. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. This just feels like a small mystery that's never solved. Was the guy lying? And if so, why? I'm just wondering if this could be something that pops up again in the future when Patterson wants more revenge, maybe.
It could be. I wonder if Patterson was temporarily offering a higher pay to lure good workers away from Strike.
That could be
as part of his campaign. You know, he might have gone back on that higher offer after a few months.
Yeah, maybe.
Although once he got arrested, everyone's out of a job there anyways. Like, you backed the wrong horse, Mr. Anonymous interviewee.
That could be true. But because it's a book, it just feels interesting.
It feels deliberate.
Yeah. You'd think a friend of Wardle's might want to work with Strike, but maybe Wardle doesn't actually know the guy that well.
I just can't fathom
why someone would not want to work for the Strike and Ellicott Detective Agency. Like, excuse me.
It just doesn't make any sense.
I'm taking personal offense. Well, right. No, they're the best. Everyone knows they're the best. Why would you pick Patterson?
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you get the opportunity to work for the best private detective agency in London and you go with Patterson instead? I mean, red flags, dude. Yeah. Red fucking flags.
I'm just really curious about this.
Maybe it'll come up in book 8.
Strike also tells Robin that Pat is in a bad mood and then says that Murphy couldn't write a letter because he had to go up north.
I love that he includes Pat's bad mood in this. It's just really cute.
It is.
See how everyone's miserable without you, Robin, he says internally. I mean, I know that's not the reason for Pat's bad mood, but
no,
it's still cute that he included that for Robin, just to give her an update.
She's probably remembering all the other times that Pat has been in a bad mood and that he's been in a bad mood.
What did you do to piss her off, Strike?
So there's a lot of talk in the fandom about this bit about Murphy going up north, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some of it, mostly from Twitter, that people think he went to visit the Ellicotts.
Yeah, I'm personally very worried about this, that this is the case. But, you know, you'd think that Murphy would take the time or find a way to get a note to her, even if he had to go up north. Like, leave one with Pat before you leave. You know, write one and drop it in the mail a few days ahead of time from up north if you have that little notice. It just feels like a lack of effort to me.
Can't you even just like email one to Pat and
email
have him print it even if you can't handwrite it?
Yes, that is the lowest effort. Pat would be thrilled to print the email. It's not like you're writing her super secret.
I know, love notes.
Your messages are so bland and boring anyways. Was it a matter if Pat sees them? Crazy to me that he didn't bother to find a way to get a note to her. Do you think Strike would ever just not bother?
No.
Please.
This is kind of why I think him going up north has to do with the murder case he's working on.
Mm-hmm.
Because it'd be something where you just have to up and go really quickly. But I wouldn't dislike it if it was true and he visited the Ellicotts, because it would just add to the drama of what I think and expect is going to happen with the Murphy-Linda relationship.
Yeah, I think it probably had to do with the murder case, but somehow I also wouldn't be surprised if he went to visit her family either. I think I've seen people wondering whether he was going up there to ask for a blessing to propose, but I'm not sure that I buy that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that either, but it kind of falls in the category of, eh.
We'll see.
I don't know. We'll see. I think it's a possibility. But I don't know. He's been having all these long talks with Linda. Maybe he was up north for murder and just took a detour and dropped in. Possible. But if I was Robin, I would be real mad if I found out he did this, which is why I'm hoping he did and that it comes out in book 8.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
It's why I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm worried about it because I think that it could lead to the fight I'm expecting.
Also, I love that in Strike's note, he left the Murphy bit until last because, you know, he was so annoyed at having to write down his stupid name and pass along his stupid message. Like, just very grumpy about it. He's like, yeah, fine, I have to write this bit about Murphy. Fuck.
Strike is like, you belong with me.
Oh my God, he's Taylor Swift and pulling up like notes through the window. Oh my God.
This just in, Cormoran Strike is Taylor Swift.
Dreaming about the day when she wakes up and finds that what she's looking for has been here the whole time.
Oh my God. That's literally, it's literally him. It's like, he is handsome. I look like a boxer. Oh my God. Someone please record the Strike version of You Belong With Me by Taylor Swift. I need to hear it.
All right. So he ends the letter the way he ends them all, telling her as soon as she's ready, he'll come get her out. I will never not love this.
And by telling her to take care of herself. He knows full well that it's very likely Robin will sacrifice her own well-being and safety to get what they need. So he's doing his best to make sure that she actually considers her own needs too.
Robin's letter to Strike made me feel kind of sad. The acknowledgement that women getting their hair shaved as a punishment was terrifying, as I've said. And I felt so bad for those two young women. Robin seeing the marks on the back of one of them clearly tells me that she had been in the box.
Mm-hmm.
Her accidental use of the word materialist also made me feel sad because it's proof that she's being institutionalized.
It is. But, you know, at least she caught herself and crossed it out.
If I were Robin, I would have written it and then put it in quotes with like an eye roll.
That's smart. That is smart. Clever.
You know, so he doesn't know that I messed up. She's also worried about what to do about giving money.
Probably worried about what they'll do to her if she can't.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that she brought this up now so that the money was ready to go soon. And she didn't have to suffer as long as she maybe could have.
And then the saddest part is the ending when she tells him that she doesn't want to leave, but thinks about how that's a lie. Uh-huh. I think this is the part where my absolute ache for her to leave started. Yeah. You know, I knew she couldn't and wouldn't yet, but it was just an ache, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hear you. I felt the exact same way.
It hurts.
Also, when she says, "I swear I'm trying," it's like, Robin, he knows.
Oh, my God. If there's one thing Strike knows in this world, Robin, it's that you're trying your damnedest. Come on. Yes.
While this is going on, you know, he's over here telling the team, yeah, you know, Robin, no half measures. She's going all out.
Oh, I really need these two to just
get their shit together.
Yes, so they can just be honest with how they feel about each other, because it'll just be like a gush fest. All the things they keep suppressed.
So she ends her letter with, please keep the chocolate coming, which I adore, because I feel like that's Q Strike buying pounds and pounds of chocolate to try and stuff it in the rock. He's like, how can I fit the maximum amount of chocolate in this rock for Robin so I don't let her down? You know, I will keep the chocolate coming. By God, if it's the last thing on earth I do, I will keep her chocolate coming.
Let's go to 47.
So in chapter 47, Strike receives an alarming phone call from both Tasha Mayo and Charlotte.
The epigraph, 9 at the beginning means, when ribbon grass is pulled up, the sod comes with it. And that's hexagram 11, peace. I think this is a really good one, because when you pull up grass, the sod comes with it, meaning you get to the root of the problem. This is when Strike tells Charlotte that the two of them were never friends. And while I think they have many roots of many problems, this is the key piece that has to be there in a relationship, and they never had it. I just think it's so sweet, because implying that the root of the problem with Strike and Charlotte was that they were never friends, and contrasting that with Strike and Robin, who are best friends, which is going to not be the root of a problem, but the foundation for the rest of their relationship.
Like the roots of an ancient oak tree. It's beautiful and growing. But that is a really good interpretation. I love it. And you know, it would seem ironic that this hexagram is about peace and harmony when the actual phone calls in this chapter are anything but peaceful on the surface. But it's like you said, he's gotten to the root of the problem now. And this final break with Charlotte is going to lead him to peace.
We'll talk more about what I think this phone call does for Strike, but I do think that there's some peace for him in this call for him.
Yeah.
All right. So this chapter opens with Strike sending an update to Sir Colin and telling him about the things that Robin has found so far.
I think I forgot at this point that Sir Colin still needs to approve and agree with Robin staying in, since they're billing him for it.
Yep.
So that's why Strike is recommending it on Robin's request and saying that she thinks she can find more.
I'm still curious about whether or not they're billing for 24/7 work. Because if they did, Sir Colin would have paid them an absolute fortune by the time this was over.
They better be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she is in there working.
I'm just thinking, what would my boss charge $44 an hour?
I feel like they charge more than that.
Yeah, that's $1,056. I know this is pounds, but $1,056. Let's times that by 31. So 1 month would be $32,736.
Wow. I feel like they could charge double that with all their rich clients and their fame.
Oh, yeah.
Easy. Totally. Triple.
And that's just for Robin's work.
And that's just for Robin's work.
Yeah. Strike is still doing billable hours outside, too. Ooh.
That would be a nice chunk of cash for them. She earned it.
Okay, so let's talk about this phone call with Tasha Mayo. So Strike gets a call from Tasha, and she's screaming because the snake has been put through her letterbox.
I probably would, too. Deeply unsettling.
Yeah, for sure. And that's one way of putting it. I would have been scared shitless. There are some people like Tasha who like and can be around snakes. I am not one of those people. I hate snakes.
I feel like I'm learning so much about you today.
I know, Ken. We're learning so much about Ken's this episode. I love snakes. They're little danger noodles.
Definitely wouldn't like a snake where it's not supposed to be.
I mean, one slithering out from under my couch would definitely be very alarming. Yeah. I would be up on the furniture. Yeah, I'd be like, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love the moment in this phone call where Tasha calms down a bit and says that she put the snake in the bath and that it was harmless. She's not actually afraid of them, because the whole phone call made her feel more like a real person to me. But that moment in particular made her suddenly seem like a much more interesting and rounded character than I'd expected. Like, oh, Tasha's actually getting a personality and some backstory here. I am intrigued.
I feel like we can sum up a lot of this here, that They conclude it was done the previous evening, and Strike, having checked in with both Barkley and Midge, realized that neither of the Franks could have done it. Mm-hmm. He also knows that both Little John and Dev were off the previous evening. Mm-hmm. I think I remember understanding what his suspicions were here, that Little John did it.
I don't think that I picked up on that the first time that I read it, just because I was reading so fast, but it definitely became more obvious reading it more slowly.
I'm the same.
Definitely knew it wasn't Dev.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, Dev is absolutely out of suspicion. Not. Of course it wasn't Dev. Of course. Dev.
So let's get to the phone call with Charlotte, because this is really the highlight of the chapter.
I know. Again, roller coaster of emotions for me.
You're running so many roller coasters on this episode. You got to get off. You're going
to
get nauseous.
And I haven't even had to wait in line.
Amazing.
I started out worried because Charlotte has been contacted by a journalist asking for dirt on Strike.
And we're like, oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that could have been potentially disastrous.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not only Charlotte. We also have Madeline, Ellen, and Kiara.
Yikes.
We know that none of these women spoke badly about him, but Kiara's reaction is my favorite. Just laughing at them and hanging up.
Yeah.
It makes me like her so much more.
I like her. I mean, a one night stand 6 years ago, and then he turned her down when she wanted to go out again. I'd have laughed too if I was Kiara, because that's just ridiculous.
I know. I don't really think that Madeline, Ellen, or Kiara really would have had anything truthfully bad or scandalous to say.
Yeah.
Madeline would have been the one I'd worry about the most because she believed the things that Charlotte told her and because she's the most,
well,
you know,
unhinged. The lack of hinges is somewhat apparent in her behavior.
It is. But I think that her own behavior during their relationship might deter her from wanting to get involved.
Quite, yes. I mean, I would not be saying a word if I was Madeline, because, you know, there's still that assault.
Yeah.
And the worst Ellen could say was, oh, he forgot a date once and ruined a dress by spilling some wine. Like, oh, no, what a monster.
It's kind of funny that out of the women we've seen him date, the journalist asked the three who have the least to complain about, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I really don't think that either Nina or Lorelai would have said anything if they'd been asked, because I don't think either of them are vindictive women. I think they're both good women, but it just seems to me like enough time has passed, right? Especially with Lorelai. I don't think she's still in love with him. She's not still hurt. And what is she going to say? He couldn't emotionally commit. I don't think that's the kind of tea they're after.
No.
They'd be like, okay, thanks for your time. Oh, bye. Wow. That's not what they want.
Like 90% of the other men in London.
Nina might have the best gossip that he used her to get information for a case, right? I just don't think that she would. After all this time,
sleeping with her a few times and then ghosting her isn't a scandal. And she couldn't very well say that he stole the Bombyx Maury manuscript from Robichard without implicating herself. So she's not going to do that. Yeah, no.
I guess Charlotte really is the one who could have caused the most damage, because she could have lied.
Full of bullshit. Yeah.
So Charlotte says that she doesn't believe that he's ever slept with a client. He's very honorable, has good ethics, and is nothing like his father.
I mean, I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I agree with Charlotte.
A broken clock is right twice a day, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of sad, because if any other woman said this to the press, any other ex, I wouldn't really question it, because I think it's true. With Charlotte, though, I think her motivation is to get back in his good graces by actually trying to not be nice, because I don't think she would have done this if it didn't benefit her. But her other tactics haven't worked. So I think her thought process is, let me actually help him by doing what's right, and maybe he'll come back to me.
Which is a nice gesture, but like, honestly, lady, too little, too late.
I will say that Kiara and Nina were a toe on the line for me, getting too close to a case, but they certainly weren't clients.
Yeah. Kiara especially, because Nina just worked for Quine's publisher, but Kiara was one of the victim's best friends. She could have easily turned out to be the actual murderer, right?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think that Strike would do this now.
No, he wouldn't now.
I was also feeling worried at this point, because it says Strike couldn't have said what he was feeling, except a dim surprise mixed with some ghostly vestige of what he'd once felt for her, resurrected by the sorrowful voice he'd sometimes heard at the end of their worst fights. How did you both feel with this?
I liked the mention that it was ghostly.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting phrasing given what happens to her later, but I don't think I was ever worried about this.
I wasn't worried though. Like, the language here is, it's muted and it's fleeting. It's the ghost of his love, because his love is dead. You know, there's no bringing it back to life. And I also had the feeling that Charlotte was about to unleash some crazy and that little ghostly feeling would vanish pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
The other bits that were a little strange for me was when their conversation started to feel almost friendly. And they were kind of laughing at Charlotte saying she never wanted to ruin his life. No, you just didn't mind messing with it, shit stirring with Madeline, and Charlotte saying she did do that a bit.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he asks her how she is, how her health is, if she's okay.
I didn't mind this at all, actually. I think it's the only civil and pleasant exchange we've ever seen between them. And
yeah,
I liked getting a tiny glimpse into what their dynamic might have been like in the more peaceful times in their relationship. I've always been curious about that because we mostly just see the horrible parts.
Yeah, I can totally read it that way now.
Yeah.
But my first read, I was just too stressed to be rational. I agree, though, it is very interesting.
I think for me, the first read of this bit, it went by so quickly. I didn't have time to feel feelings about it. I'm like, oh my God, what's going to happen?
Oh, I'm like the girl on Mean Girls. I just have a lot of feelings.
You don't That's even me. Go here.
Back to him asking her about her health, though. Mm-hmm. Charlotte saying she caught it early was her plan all along, right? Oh, I had to do some treatment and now I'm fine.
This is a real special brand of Charlottean backpedaling. I think that once she realized that I have cancer bit wasn't going to work, that she needed to make it no longer be an issue.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, man, if this is the same kind of shit that she pulled when she and Strike were still together, I mean, I just can't imagine being with somebody like that. It just sounds exhausting.
Yeah, it does.
But, you know, a part of me does wonder if this is basically the same thing that happened when they split up the baby.
Oh, yeah. The same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just felt so much relief when he says probably the most important and truthful thing he said to her when he says that they can't get a drink even as friends because they were never friends.
Oh, my God.
I remember going,
right? Like, gasp.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a really underrated moment, I feel like. It just like in general. Also, don't believe for a second that she would have kept that drink to being a drink as just friends. It never would have stayed way.
Of course, that's not what she wanted.
That's not what she wanted.
Yeah, she's so full of it.
God, you absolutely know that Strike was thinking about Robin when he said this bit, right?
No, exactly.
Because Robin has his back. Robin wants him to be okay. Robin doesn't rip him to pieces when there's a problem. And vice versa. Oh my God. It's emotions closet
friends.
Time.
I find it really interesting that Strike says we. He says that friends don't do what we did to each other.
Yeah.
Because we know that Charlotte physically abused him, emotionally abused him with threats of suicide, cheated, lied pathologically. I think we know that Strike didn't do those things. But I think we also know that he had to have contributed to the toxicity of that relationship. I think we saw proof of that in Ink Black Heart.
Mm-hmm. I think she always brought out the worst in him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this reminds me a lot of Robin. Because like Strike, Robin could easily put all the blame on Matthew for their divorce. But she is very honest with herself about her role in that. Mm-hmm. Well, besides acknowledging her feelings for Strike. But this conversation between Strike and Charlotte reminded me of that scene in Troubled Blood between Matthew and Robin where they settle the divorce and make peace as best as they can.
That was the exact vibe that I was getting.
Yeah.
At least before Charlotte takes it completely off the rails.
With Matthew and Robin, I feel like that peace was much more beneficial to Robin than it is to Matthew. And I get that same feeling here. Strike using we feels like an acknowledgement of the things that he did wrong too. And it almost feels like he's putting any anger behind him about what she did.
Yeah.
In the same way that Robin did.
The self-awareness and the taking accountability for his past mistakes really is incredible growth for him. And I feel like it might be time for me to bust out my, I am so proud of this 41-year-old fictional man hat again.
So proud of him.
So proud.
I feel like we need that on a t-shirt.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, my God. That's an amazing t-shirt. Okay. I got to design that.
There was a part of me that wondered if this could be the same kind of thing between Strike and Charlotte and that it would be done now. I know that's a lot to expect from Charlotte, but I thought that Charlotte's understanding that Strike now wanting friendship in a romantic relationship and that it has to do with Robin, because obviously she concludes that they're together now, it might make her understand fully that not only does he not love her anymore, but he loves Robin and all hope is gone.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happens here. This is the moment where Charlotte finally understands he's never coming back to her. He's done. And she actually internalizes that. She accepts that.
It is what happened, but I guess I just still had the naive hope for Charlotte that she could move on now that she understood this. Will I sound like an absolutely insane person if I say that sometimes I feel bad for her because I think she genuinely feels like she lost the love of her life? I know it's her fault, but it still does make me feel a little sad.
I feel a bit bad for her too. She had serious problems, and I think she genuinely believed that Strike was the only thing that could help her. This must have been a blow, a physical blow for her, him saying that and her realizing this.
The fact that it took her until this moment to understand that he really and truly wasn't coming back is pretty wild to me, though, because he's been steadily rejecting her advances for the past 6 years. Yeah. I mean, do you think that there were a lot of times whenever they weren't together in those 16 years on and off where he said he didn't want to get back together only to relent? So that's why his previous rejections up until now didn't work?
Oh, definitely.
Maybe that's obvious.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just seems nuts that she needed to hear all of this before she truly understood that he's not in love with her anymore and he really isn't coming back.
I guess I just partly feel bad because I don't think that I'm ever going to get over Cormoran Strike or Robin for that matter. I feel like I'm going to love these books for the rest of my life. So I guess I empathize a bit.
Oh yeah, that is a mood.
Yeah. And this is the last time he ever speaks to her, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, it is. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that before. You know what? I'm glad the last thing he said to her was that he wishes her well. He doesn't have to feel bad about the last words he said to her.
I suppose the idea I had of Strike making peace as best he can with her could be true for him with this phone call.
Yeah, I think so.
Didn't go as well as Matthew and Robin's last conversation, but I think Strike's ability to not be angry with her, to speak rationally, to speak the absolute truth was important for him. Mm-hmm. And to do it kindly and with, you know.
Yeah, it was.
I'm glad that this is how he can remember their last conversation and the last things he said to her.
Oh, I'm so excited to get the chapter where he talks to her in the church.
Okay, let's go to 48.
Strike receives an update on Bigfoot from Dev and does some more research into Cherie Gittens.
The epigraph reads, "The inferior man's wickedness is visited upon himself. His house is split apart. A law of nature is at work here." And that's from Hexagram 23, splitting apart.
This is the first time we get an inferior man epigraph. And I'm not trying to be petty, which is a lie, because of course I am. I had so wanted this to be about Murphy when I first read this book, but no, it's not. I think we have quite a few options for inferior men in this chapter. Mm-hmm. The biggest one, and I think probably the most likely, is Bigfoot himself.
Yeah.
This is a Bigfoot-heavy chapter where Dev gets the evidence that he needs against him, and Bigfoot's wife is thrilled, Mrs. Foot. Mm-hmm. That's not funny. So that really fits here, where his own wickedness is catching up to him, and his house is split apart, because now Mrs. Foot is going to file for divorce again.
Mrs. Foot.
And get her settlement.
Maybe she can go join a first cryptid wives club with Mrs. Moth and Mrs. Ness.
There you go. Another man mentioned in this chapter, although very briefly, is Jonathan Wace. Strike sees a poster with Wace at the beginning of the chapter, and his wickedness definitely catches up to him later. His house is split apart, so maybe is a hint of what's to come for him. Mm-hmm. There's also Little John, because we find out Strike has sent Shanker's friends to do surveillance on him, so it's possible that whatever he's up to will catch up to him. Mm-hmm. And then there's Barry Saxon at the very end of the chapter, or Baz, who's Abigail's friend or acquaintance. This actually doesn't apply to him because we know that he's telling the truth, but we are set up not to believe him with a chapter full of inferior men. I think that's also priming us not to trust him. So if this epigraph is speaking to him, it's maybe a red herring. Having said all of that, I think that Bigfoot is the most likely inferior man here.
Yeah. I mean, I think they can all be inferior men at the same time.
It's a lot of them.
I have a special disgust for Bigfoot. I'm not going to lie. His behavior is a slander to the noble cryptid for whom he's named.
Noble.
Very rude noble. To all Bigfoots out there just minding their own business in the forest. Mm-hmm. They should sue for defamation, probably.
They should. Then we'd know they exist.
No deep insights. I'm just offended on behalf of Bigfoots everywhere. Big feet. What's the plural for Bigfoots? And what's the,
I don't know.
What's the collective noun? Are they like a stomping of Bigfoots?
I like big feet.
That's I like good. Big feet too.
I saw a herd of big feet over there.
It's stomping. They're stomping. Like a murder of crows.
A murder of crows, the stomping of big feet.
That sounds like a YA fantasy series. Catherine Kent's second effort.
Like I said with the epigraph, the chapter starts with Strike seeing a poster of Wace and the slogan, "Do you admit the possibility?"
Oh man, I'd be tempted to go in there with a marker and add that I'm an asshole to the end of that slogan.
Yeah.
I'd be graffitiing a mustache and devil horns onto Wace.
Yeah.
"Do you admit the possibility that this is a fucking cult?"
I wonder if it makes Strike mad to look at him knowing that he's the reason his best friend is gone right now. You know, that's how I would feel. Mm-hmm. I'd be secretly trying to give it the finger without anyone seeing.
I don't care who sees. I'd absolutely flip that guy off in plain sight. Fuck that guy.
He's totally doing that in his head every time he walks by one of those stupid billboards.
100%.
But then he gets a call from Dev, and Dev is talking all funny because he got hit by Bigfoot in the face.
Well, at least that's proof that he exists. Take that to the tabloids.
I guess it's a really good thing Dev got the shot, though, and caught him, because I think Bigfoot definitely realizes that he's being followed and watched now.
Yeah, I think he's figured it out.
Something similar happened to one of my investigators once, where this target that we'd been working on for a long time, finally, he got the shot that we needed, but it resulted in the target catching him and then chasing him down the street.
Oh my God.
Which was even more perfect because the claim was that they couldn't walk.
Oh.
So it was hilarious. And luckily he got away.
That's amazing. Did he manage to get the whole chasing him part on tape? Because that would have been very funny.
Yeah. He came to the office and we just kept watching it over and over again laughing because it was so funny. That one was particularly satisfying because it was really difficult to get this person.
Hmm. Can we call us a bit of a parallel with Troubled Blood? Someone's nose getting smashed and Strike taking care of them with ice. I mean, although this time it wasn't Strike's fault.
Also much less romantic.
Less romantic, yes.
So Dev and Strike are now at a pub and talking about taking on a new case, even though the Franks case might have a third stalker. But Strike says he's having the third party watched by some cash in hand blokes.
This is almost a blink and you'll miss it comment here, especially if you're a very stressed reader on your first read. But he's talking about having Shanker's friends follow Little John. I don't know if Dev picks up on this or understands what Strike means, though.
I'm inclined to think that Dev just understands that Strike doesn't really want to give details, because I mean, how many people at the agency know about Shanker and his associates beyond Strike and Robin?
I'm guessing Strike doesn't really invite Shanker around to their office parties. I think the agency has the general idea that Strike has some shadier connections that are sometimes useful.
But what I mean is, I'm wondering if Dev understands Strike's suspicions that it's Little John.
I don't know,
because obviously he's saying, "I know who the third party is, I'm having him watched."
Yeah,
I just feel like Dev might make the connection.
Maybe.
By the way, I still love the little casual reminders of how well they're doing financially, because Strike's comments that he's paying for these cash in hand blokes is costing him a fortune. And then he tells Dev that he'll buy him a new phone since his was cracked. Just think back to Lethal White. Wasn't Strike using a cracked phone for a while because he couldn't afford to replace one?
Yeah, he had to wait until Chisel paid them to replace it.
Yeah.
I just realized that Strike's phone was smashed and Robin's was dropped into the canal in Lethal White. Mm-hmm. In this book, Robin's phone is too old to hold a charge, supposedly, and Dev's get smashed. So that's two phone deaths in each book. And then in each book, the murder was done by more than one person.
Interesting.
I feel like connecting there's dots to connect there.
I'm just saying about the money thing that I love this for them, and he can totally afford a ring. Just saying.
Oh, yeah. He totally can, now that he's running the best detective agency in London with his best friend.
Mm-hmm.
Either of you have any thoughts about what kind of ring Robin would like?
It's got to be something totally different from the one Matthew gave her, right?
No sapphires.
Yeah, no sapphire. I think she'd look better in gold or rose gold than the platinum. I feel like something really beautiful and intricate, but not flashy. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Unique. What do you guys think?
I don't know. Because I mean, if I think about that, I just think of things that I like.
Right. I know, I do the exact same thing. But Strike would totally be into buying her a ring, right? Because after all that time having to look at Matthew's ring and then dreading one showing up from Murphy, he's going to want to look at her left hand, see the sparkle, and be like, "That is my fiance. I put that ring on her. That's me."
He totally will be.
Yeah.
With all the gifts we see him give her and the significance they hold, this will be the ultimate gift because it's his heart that he's really giving.
Oh, stop.
That got super cheesy really fast. I'm sorry. Sue me. But
I'm not
going to
sue you. It's too good.
Strike has the sudden thought to ask Dev where his wife hangs out online, with the intention of trying to figure out where to look for Sheree Gittens. I've just also realized that we learn his wife's name. I think we do. I think it's Aisha.
It's Aisha for sure.
The only reason I was wondering is just because, you know, he's having trouble speaking. So I was wondering if it could be something close, but I think that's probably her name.
I agree. And it's a real name.
I Googled it. It says Aisha is a feminine name of Arabic origin, meaning alive and well.
Well, alive and well seems promising, unless that's ironic and she's going to die in an upcoming book. I hope not.
Not Aisha. Yeah. I'm so attached now.
I actually am super attached now. No joke.
I can't remember if we looked up Dev's name when we first met him in Ink Blackheart, but I looked like it up again just in case. Dev means God and Shah means king, which is a lot of pressure for one human man. You know, maybe J.K. Rowling just really likes Dev.
Yeah, she likes him as a character. I mean, he's a handsome and talented subcontractor. You know, there you go. I get it. He's living up to the pressure.
Yeah. Anyway, we know Dev's wife's name now. I think we should learn Barclay's.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. We haven't, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't say somewhere in Lethal White and none of us remember. This isn't some weird folly ado shared delusion that we all have, right?
No. I think she's just sort of obliquely referred to as the wife, you know, when Barclay talks about her. But we need to learn her name. And what is their kid's name?
Oh, yeah. Can I say, I love that Aisha is always on Mum's Net or Bub's Net. Because I, too, am always on Mum's Net. The Am I Being Unreasonable form is the best secondhand drama on the internet. It's so good.
Oh, you'll be shocked, but I had never even heard of this website until a while back when someone mentioned it. I think it was Lamp mentioned it. And I was like,
I don't believe it.
So anyway, Strike heads back to the office where he finds Pat listening to her oldies.
Which is another Trouble Blood parallel.
It is.
Although sadly, no Robin in a particularly sexy dress this time.
That is sad.
Yeah.
You know what's so fun about Pat and Strike is that even though I think they both really like each other now, there's still that bit of friendly antagonism that we all really like. Because when Strike tells Pat that Dev got punched by Bigfoot, it says that she glares at him as though he was personally responsible, which is so funny. And then they have this little sarcastic back and forth where Pat says that the next client on the waiting list is the weirdo with the mother. They all have mothers, don't they? Said Strike.
Their banter truly is world class. Like the only banter in these books that can rival Strike and Robin's.
It's so funny when Strike calls the weirdo with the mother because it says he had an upper class accent so pronounced Strike found it hard to believe he wasn't putting it on.
I feel like this is another tiny like in-book parallel between Robin and Strike's chapters. So like Bijou's red dress right before Robin gets her scarlet tracksuit. We've got Strike talking to this guy with his accent versus Vivian being torn apart in Revelation for faking a middle-class accent a couple chapters ago. Oh, like, there are little echoes in each other's lives, connecting them while they're separated, maybe?
Yeah, I love that.
Or maybe I'm just reaching.
No, let's keep an eye out for that, see if we find any more.
Yeah, I like let's. That. I want to see that.
Well, I can think of one other one offhand.
What?
What?
I think this is qualified as what you're talking about.
Oh, is it the bit where he dreams about her drowning and then she drowns?
Yes, that's the one. That's the one.
He dreams about talking to her about drowning while sitting in the Land Rover and then she drowns and she thinks of him in the Land Rover.
Uh-huh.
That one hits hard. Yeah.
It does. It does. Right in the gut.
I think this just shows that they're connected. I'm like,
of course.
Level.
Yeah, soulmates. Mm-hmm. You know how I had said a while ago that I thought Strike and Robin should hire someone to do all the tedious online investigations so they can be free doing other things?
Yes. Yeah. And I agree that they should.
Strike thinks the same thing when he's sitting there at the computer for 2.5 hours trying to find Sheree. Mm-hmm. It says that he wishes that he could pay people to do this kind of work.
I feel like what Strike needs in order to solve this problem would just be having internships. That should be a thing. You know, people could get their feet wet doing investigative work without doing the riskier stuff.
And the chapter ends with Pat calling the inner office to tell him that Barry Saxon is there to see him.
Oh, fuck.
I don't know why this didn't make me look more at Abigail. This big reminder of her again out of nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, we know why. It's because we're never going to figure out the murderer.
That's true.
All right. In chapter 49, Strike interviews Barry Saxon. So the epigraph for this chapter, 9 in the third place means a goat butts against a hedge and gets its horns entangled. And that's from hexagram 34, The Power of the Great.
This image is making me think of someone who has tried to fight something bigger than they are and then ends up stuck and not knowing how to escape. I think on my first read, I was thinking that Barry was the goat and Strike was the hedge, meaning that he's trying to go up against Strike and then loses. But now that we know that he is telling the truth, I think the hedge is actually Abigail. He's entangled in this huge mess that he can't get out of.
Oh, I love that double meaning. Yes, I feel like Barry's horns are entangled in Strike's superior madness, but Strike hasn't realized how much his own horns are entangled and his bias is about Abigail. It's like, it's just goats stuck in hedges all the way down. But part of this line judgment definitely resonates with Baz for me, because it says, whereas an inferior man revels in power, when he comes into possession of it, the superior man never makes this mistake. And Barry does revel in the power he believes he has over Abigail and all the dirt he has on her and his ability to stalk and threaten her. He is very different from Strike, who sees that behavior for what it is. Because we just saw what Strike does when he has power of a woman with Bijou in an earlier chapter. He did what he had to protect himself, and then he walked away. He doesn't have this vicious desire for revenge that Baz has, because he's, you know, the superior man.
Have we pointed out the troubled blood parallel of the biases against the
Janice
and Abigail that Strike has?
I think we have, but it is very clear. Yeah, he's hoodwinked because he's inclined to put them in a particular group. Nurses, feminine, nurturing, or people who had rough childhoods and pulled themselves up by their bootstraps.
Right. I think in this one, he really sees himself in her.
Yep. And that clouds his judgment.
So first, I think it's so cool that Strike and Robin have one of those little wing things to cover up their murder board, because it says that Strike covers everything up before he comes in.
Oh, man. Look at them with the fancy murder board. Just imagining them accounting for that in their expenses. One murder board with foldable covers.
They get the best murder board. Everyone buys a murder board. Is there like a murder boards are us? Because I'd actually quite like to have one on hand just in case I ever actually have to solve a murder.
Just in case. Could happen.
I should be prepared with my murder board, right? And I only want the best.
When Barry comes in, we get a full paragraph of Strike's impression of him, which is basically Strike comparing him to that one client we know he turned down because he was afraid that the guy would hurt his wife. What book is that mentioned in?
That was chapter 10 of Lethal White. Robin was talking about an investment banker who wanted them to find his wife.
Yeah.
Oh, good catch. I totally hadn't realized that this person had been mentioned before. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You know, ever since Brockbank was first mentioned in Silkworm as a nameless alcoholic major to whom Strike was comparing Waldegrave, I have been on alert for these little comparisons in case they're introducing future characters. There was one in Inkblackheart where Wally Cardew reminded Strike of Private Dean Shaw that we felt could be a thing. And now this investment banker has come up a second time and is being used as a comparison. It's suspicious. You know, maybe his ex-wife is going to turn up murdered and they're like, oh, that guy.
Oh, I hope not.
Yeah, hopefully not.
The last chapter with him and Abigail at the pub, coupled with this assessment of him, it just made me completely ready to dismiss everything this guy is about to say.
Oh, yeah. 100%. I already loathe this guy. I love that Strike clearly dislikes him as well, because that's a mark of Strike's character, isn't it? Picking up on this guy's general horribleness.
He knows a crappy man whenever he sees one.
I assume this is exactly what J.K. Rowling intended, because one of the very next things that comes out of Barry's mouth is that Abigail killed someone while she was in the UHC.
God damn it. God damn it, Joe.
The answer is right there, but nobody believed it.
No. Exactly. Yeah. She's hiding it in plain sight and has it coming out of the mouth of a character that we're predisposed to not like.
She did the same thing with Irene.
Am I going to fall for this exact same trick every time she pulls it?
Well,
yes. Yeah. Of course I am. 100%.
Every time.
Barry is claiming that Abigail thinks the UHC killed Kevin and that he'll be next to be killed. Maybe the last one was true if he learned too much.
He doesn't seem smart enough to learn too much to me. Maybe.
Well, he would hear it from Patrick. They must be out here.
So the UHC killed Kevin was the only part of this that I actually did believe.
And that
was the only part that wasn't true, because I'm a sucker.
We get Barry complaining about Abigail and men, and it says, familiar with the commonplace male disdain for women who enjoyed an adventurous sex life that either excluded or no longer included them, Strike continued asking questions that were designed purely to assess how much credence should be given to any information Saxon had to offer. It's so funny. He had the feeling the answer might be zero. I'm sorry. It's just so funny because
God damn it.
can't remember all the stuff about him following her around. If there was any explanation as innocent or if he's doing this because he's hurt.
No, it's not innocent. He's doing this because he's an asshole stalker who wants revenge on her for rejecting him. Even in his account of what's happening, you can tell that he's stalking her. But it just so happens that Abigail also turned out to be a monster. So they're both terrible.
It's so icky when they go back to the topic of her killing someone at the UHC because he says that she was having a nightmare where she was yelling, cut it up smaller, cut it up smaller.
Ugh.
Ew.
God, of all the murders in these books, this one really is, I feel like, one of the most gruesome.
From what we know what this is now. It was Dyer's body.
Yeah.
That she's having nightmares about this. Does this suggest that she feels remorse or guilt for what happened?
Maybe. I think it could. I think Shrike says something about this later.
Yeah.
It could mean a lot of things. It could mean that she feels guilt. She could feel traumatized by it.
Yeah.
She could be worried about getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
Anything or all of it, you know?
Yeah. Because like the guilt that she feels so guilty is kind of belied by the fact that she carries on killing with apparently no problem in the present day.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
Yeah.
I think that Shrike is very correct when he thinks that Abigail's upbringing is of great interest to Barry and Patrick.
Yep.
They're like Lucy and Ethel gossiping. But it's obvious that they're trying to put all these pieces together and, you know, gossiping about it to each other.
I mean, I know Abigail's a murderer and all, but she still really needs to get rid of this lodger. Kick him out.
I don't know. I feel like the opposite, because what do we say to that woman who housed Creed, where, you know, when everyone's like, you should have known better.
Uh-huh.
And like this one, he's like, I'm on to you. I'm going to be gossiping about you.
He is nosy enough to figure her out. I
right?
Like that.
That's what funny. We want.
And, you know, since it's the lodger that lets Barkley in to get that damning evidence, Abigail, for her own sake, she probably should have kicked him out. But good for justice that she didn't.
Yeah. I'm not looking for Abigail's sake.
No. No, we don't care about Abigail's well-being. This is about justice now.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
When he's talking about cut it up smaller, his interpretation is about Paul Draper, the simple kid who got beat and then died a few years later. And I'm saying simple kid in quotes, who got beat and then died a few years later.
That's him. I'm assuming from this story and what we learn later that this beating was the actual punishment for what happened on the morning of Dayu's death.
Oh, yeah.
And the beating is what made Sheila's Brian worse, too. This was the punishment for
and
that.
His understanding of cut it up smaller is was that Abigail was trying to cut a whip up so that Mazu couldn't beat them with it.
Yeah. You know what? That story really should have sounded an alarm bell in my mind because it doesn't make sense.
Not really.
Up a whip with scissors is...
I know.
Yeah.
But again, we're just looking at Barry like, you're an idiot.
It just feels like such a constructed nonsense story now that I know.
Yeah.
I'm like, that doesn't even hang together. Oh, God.
Very good way of hiding a clue, though, right? Telling us she killed someone and then having the person who's telling the story confuse it with another person. Mm-hmm. We already don't like him, so we dismiss it.
Yeah.
And we talked before about the comparisons between Shrike and Abigail, how they both had these bad childhood experiences, but responded to them in a very different way.
Very much so. And I think we see in Shrike defending her here to Baz so strongly that he feels those similarities. He feels that.
But I think there's another being made here in a joking way. When Barry says that Abigail has a scary temper, Shrike says, if that was a crime, I'd be inside myself.
Yeah,
I bet there's no way that these scary tempers could be compared because Shrike has a temper like a human being. Abigail kills people.
Yeah. Different levels of anger there, Shrike.
Here's another little comparison. Barry is telling a story that he had once told Abigail that she's just like her father, and that really angered her. Mm-hmm. And does that not sound familiar?
That is ringing a bell for us. Mm-hmm. You're right. Who else do we know who fucking hates being told that? She really is setting us up with these comparisons to have sympathy for Abigail, just like she did with Janice in Troubled Blood.
I know.
Very rude of you, Joe. Very rude.
So this is when he says that Abigail threatened him and says that he needs to be careful because they have guns at the UHC. I was really worried about this.
Yeah.
I did not want Robin causing trouble where there are guns.
Yeah. I was like, keep those guns. far, far away from her. That time at the end of Lethal White with Raphael was enough. Thank you very much.
I definitely did not want Robin getting shot. I mean, especially if her only option for medical care is Zhao. You cannot cure gunshot wounds with essential oils. Okay.
No.
This is kind of a fun bit here where Strike asks if Abigail has seen the guns at Chapman Farm. And Baz says yes and concludes that she's therefore seen the gun that killed Kevin.
Well, yeah, I mean, it hangs together. There's only one gun in the UK. Did you not know? There's just the one.
Strike says that she can't have seen the gun that killed Kevin because he was killed by a model that didn't exist back when she was at the UHC. It's just kind of funny because we know that she absolutely saw the gun that killed Kevin because she was holding it.
Oh, oops. Yep.
Yeah.
The dramatic irony on a reread there is just too delicious. Of course she saw the gun.
So I don't know. It really seems like he's there because he says he feels threatened and that he's worried. He wants Strike to take him seriously and all his gossip, but we are not ready to believe him.
I don't think Baz is actually really worried that Abigail's gonna do anything real to him. Like, what does he actually have to fear from her at this point, not knowing that she's actually shooting people herself? I don't think he took her threat about the church seriously. I think he's just scraping together anything he can to make himself look like a victim and drop Abigail in the shit. This is about hurting her, I think.
I don't know.
No?
I mean, I'd have to go and reread everything about Barry and this stuff, but I don't think it's out of the question to be afraid of her at this point, because people talk, especially we know Barry and Patrick.
Yeah.
And she ends up having men follow Strike and Robin around.
Yeah, but she's not
doing
it now. They kind
of know she has a gut. No, but what else has she done? I mean, I feel like there's potential for other things to
have gone around. For Barry being afraid right now, though, all she's done is threaten him when he was stalking her and say, oh, the church will shoot you if you talk badly about him. He doesn't know any of this.
I just don't know what he knows, because we know that Patrick tells him all of this stuff. I could understand someone sensing this stuff in her and being afraid, or him hearing rumors. I could see both things being true.
Maybe, but I don't sense any actual fear in Barry in any part of this chapter. I only see vindictiveness in him.
I just feel like there's something there, especially because we know he's right.
Yeah, well.
But we could come back to it.
We can come back to it. Just maybe we have different reads on what he's saying in this chapter.
I love this bit with Pat at the end where, after Barry storms out, she says that she didn't trust him because of his piggy little eyes. You'd be right not to trust him, said Strike, but not because of his piggy little eyes. I just feel like Strike is so fed up and annoyed at Pat's habit of judging people by their looks.
Yeah.
And he's not wrong.
No, he's not. I think it was Pat's betrayal by joining Team Murphy was the final straw with
this. Of course it is. Absolutely it is.
That's it. Too far, Pat. Too far.
But also, piggy little eyes being used in the same chapter where we're hearing about Cut It Up Smaller and Abigail. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Oh my God. You're right.
Yeah, I love that.
God damn it. Yes, of course.
Yeah. Mm. And then the chapter ends with Strike reluctantly calling Murphy to discuss the possibility of guns being at Chapman Farm.
Literally his last resort.
I was glad he did this, though, because this was the only thing Barry said that I was 100% willing to believe and I was scared of.
Yeah.
I was just looking forward to more interaction between Strike and Murphy, just for my own entertainment, you know?
Yeah, Strike's internal monologue during his and Murphy's conversation is one of my favorites in this book.
All right. Those were, again, fun chapters.
Wow. Yeah.
Very fun.
Should we jump into our cheese segment?
We should come up with a name for it, shouldn't we?
We should. Maybe someone can send us a suggestion about what it could be.
Give us some suggestions for what to call this segment, like the Nutter Drawer.
The Nutter Chat.
Yeah, I have no ideas, but I bet listeners have some good ideas.
Yeah, well, let's do it. Let's jump into it.
Okay.
What are we going to talk about?
I mean, what is the one topic that we are all currently obsessed with?
Yeah, the traitors.
The traitors.
Oh my God.
If you have Peacock, so you can watch the British one, the American one, and the Australian one. I have not watched the Australian one yet, but I will.
It's on Crave up here in Canada.
Okay.
For any of my Hooven comrades.
It was like, what does that mean? And now I get it. It took a second. No, I get it.
We caught up on season one. We finished it. Fantastic.
It's so funny whenever people are like, oh man, this person is definitely not a traitor. He is a hundred. And then they're like, yeah, I'm a traitor.
But it's hilarious because they forget that the traitors are just chosen to make good TV. They're like, no, this person's a friend. This person's too good a person to be a traitor. I'm like, you know, this is a game, right?
I know. It's so funny the way they always get caught up in that.
It is. But this season, we're loving this, right?
I love it.
Oh my God. I'm living for it. And the latest twist ending.
Don't say it. Don't say it. Kent hasn't seen it yet.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I won't say it, but I'm excited.
Hey, we got an email this morning.
Oh.
From Michelle. Mm-hmm. In response to our last talk.
Right.
Our last cheese chat or whatever we're going to call it. When we were talking about doing a cycling app.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, remember how exciting that idea was?
You're like, yeah. I'm going to fake my own death.
I legit might.
This email, she's recommending one called the Conquer Virtual Challenges. Oh. Sounds really, really cool.
Okay.
There are maps and medals you can earn.
Medals?
She said something about the London Challenge would be great for you guys to start. You can do it with other people.
Interesting.
Sounds very fun.
Maybe. I do like gamified things.
Yeah.
It does provide a little bit of extra incentive.
Yeah. I do like to win things. I do like to earn prizes and medals and stuff.
And the fact that it's a physical medal and it's not just like a medal on your phone.
Yeah. She says that they also have theme challenges like Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones. There's a Scooby-Doo
one.
Lord
of the Rings would be fun.
She says, I keep hoping they'll add Harry Potter. It's a real possibility. They're hopefully working out the rights soon.
Is Lord of the Rings cycling from the Shire to Mordor? Because that would be cool, cycling to Mount Doom. I might do that.
Okay, I clicked the link. Mm-hmm. It says the One Ring cannot stay in the Shire. It must be destroyed. Are you up for the Are you up for the challenge? Follow Frodo's epic journey through Middle Earth with the Lord of the Rings virtual challenge series. Walk, run, or cycle all the way from the Shire to Mount Doom in an epic adventure with one goal, destroying the One Ring.
I love it. Okay, that might convince me to sign up. That might actually work.
This email from Michelle was so great because she put links in everything. So when she said hit the London Challenge, she linked us to the London Challenge, which I really want to do. It's 75 miles. London Virtual Challenge takes you on 75 mile route through some of the city's most colorful neighborhoods, starting from the historic towns of Windsor and making stops in Hampton Court Palace.
Nice.
The business district of Canary Wharf and the political center of Westminster. Before finishing with the iconic London Eye and the South Bank of the River Thames. Start your fitness journey with a London Virtual Challenge today and earning a stunning medal. I want a medal that says London on it. I feel like I deserve that.
I feel like if you had a medal, you'd basically just be like Strike. You'd be the same.
You'd That's be how twins. It works, right?
Totally the same thing.
Same, yeah, it's a medal.
Medal for riding my bike, hero medal. Medals. For,
well, we don't know. It could have been bike related. There could have been a bike involved somewhere. We can't know. So, yeah.
Anyway, we just got this morning. I haven't had time to email Michelle back, but as soon as we're done recording, I'm going to look into this. I really want to do this.
Okay. Yeah. Let's look into that. Cause I want to do the Lord of the Rings one now. Kenz, I don't know if you're with me on that. I want to be Frodo.
Yeah. That sounds really fun.
Mostly cause I'm in love with Sam Gamgee. Road trip with him.
I think it's a great idea.
Well, thank
I'm
you.
I'm super excited. Yes. Thank you, Michelle.
Okay. We're going to have to check that out and check in about it.
Yeah,
on these updates.
We can do our status update for what medals we're getting.
So it's been 2 months and I haven't actually gotten out of the Shire. I feel like the Ringwraiths are about to catch up to me and kill me. Mm-hmm. But
People are going to want to know if you've saved the ring or whatever. I don't know how the Lord of the Ring works.
Oh, yeah. You should watch it. Well, I don't know if you'd like Lord of the Rings.
I've tried so many times to watch Lord of the Rings.
Really?
And I just can't.
It's too fun.
It's too fun?
Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
I jokes.
I think for a long time, I really thought that I liked fantasy because I love Harry Potter so much.
But you don't.
But I just don't. It took me a long time to realize that because I was like, why don't I like these? Because I love Harry Potter.
You just don't like the genre.
I guess. I mean, some of them I liked, but overall, I just don't think that it's, I don't like.
I get it.
Yeah.
I get
Harry
it.
Potter is different.
There's
J.K. Rowling.
I get it. There's, you know what? Everyone has their preferred genres. I happen to love fantasy a lot. It's not everyone's.
Yeah, I've been reading crime fiction since I was a teenager. So that's
Whereas I haven't read that much crime fiction outside of Strike.
Yeah. Or true crime. I was the kid in high school reading Helter Skelter at my desk and probably concerning the teachers a bit.
I was reading Lord of the Rings.
Before we go, I was going to ask people if there's something that you want us to talk about in this segment. Give us ideas.
Yeah.
Let us know within reason.
Credit card number.
We have the right to veto.
Social security number.
Yeah. So I added that little swooshy noise because we have now just jumped in with an update that we're recording a week after what you just heard.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, we have all looked into the London Challenge and all three of us have signed up for it.
We have.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We have. And we're all three of us excited.
Yes. I could not be more excited.
I'm excited.
You're like 20% of the way through it, right, Lindsay?
I did, but I stopped adding miles because I want to give people
time to
join us. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So I started doing a couple other ones too, just to spread it out.
You're committed.
I'm very, very motivated, apparently, by the promise of a medal.
I guess so.
I'm more motivated by avoiding humiliation. So if we could get a bunch of people to join us to witness if I fail, that
would be
most motivating to me.
Well, I think also giving updates on here, we're going to have to give updates.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be leading to a bunch of like all day cycling sessions the night before we record. I can't move my legs, but look how far I got. Definitely over the past 2 weeks, not just, you know.
Right.
I will admit that I did that today.
Did you?
I was like, oh, shit, I haven't actually gotten on my bike. I should probably do that today. Let me do that.
Well, Lindsay told me not to until we had everyone else. So I've been happily not doing it.
We'll wait.
Really
to
good
add
at following
some,
instructions.
Add some but Michelle has been really kind and helpful with getting us all situated.
Yes,
and
thank you so much, Michelle.
Mm-hmm. She's created the group for us. So if you're interested in joining us for the London Challenge, you can join our private group.
Please do.
Yes. And you can post photos or little comments. And Michelle had some fun ideas about how we can make it strike related. So strike pictures or quotes. And it's just our group that will be able to see
That's cute.
I'm still learning the app. So any questions we're going to have to direct towards Michelle.
Mm-hmm. And what's the name of the app again? So people can look it up.
The Conqueror Challenge, the Conqueror Virtual Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And then just sign up for the London one.
Yep.
The link too is also on my Twitter when I shared the post last week or something.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, one location that will pass is Hampton Court.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. So we can kind of, you know, post something fun, you know, saw Cynthia Phipps, whatever, something funny.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like I said, we'll get a real life London medal, which is very motivating for me.
Yeah, you've been kicking ass. Been like, damn, I feel like a slacker over here. Which, I mean, kind of am, but
I like to do my bike anyway. I might as well get a medal for it.
I've found that watching the old seasons of the Traitors while I'm on my bike makes me want to bike more.
Nice.
I was so focused on like, oh my God, who are they going to banish at the next round table that I wasn't thinking about, oh, like, you know, my legs are kind of starting to get a little sore or I would really rather stop now.
I would really rather stop. Yeah. I will say that just to let everyone know, it's not free. The app is free, but if you want to join the challenges, you pay for each individual challenge. So if you decide that you want to do it, you can DM us or email us and we will send you the group name and the password so you can join our group.
Yeah. And you can set right how long you want to be able to take to...
Yeah, I think you have like 2 years something
to
complete
it,
but you can change.
Yeah.
And it's not just cycling. I forgot to say, it's if you track your steps throughout the day, any kind of distance, walking, running, cycling, anything. I love looking at the Google Map feature of the app.
It's pretty cool.
They just like stroll along through London. It's great. I'm also doing the Ring of Kerry one, which is really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do the Lord of the Rings one. I'm not going to lie. I'm going to wait to see if I finish London.
When you finish.
I'm not good at finishing things, anything. I'm not going to lie. But I'm going to do it this time because the shame really works for me. So.
Once again, everybody
shame pools, please. If I don't finish, thanks. It's actually very helpful.
Just fill her mentions.
That's what made me finish that timeline. The thought of people adding me on Twitter being like, looks like you didn't fulfill your promise pools.
What are we doing next time, Kens?
All right. We are doing chapters 50 through 52. And in those chapters, Robin talks with Will and then Strike talks to Murphy about the possibility of guns at Chapman Farm.
That's a fun one, too.
Can't wait.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com. Or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.